So I just hit record. He can cut all this stuff out.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, Shane, me lad, how goes it?
Very good. Sorry, that was a terrible Irish accent. I can't do accents on
top
call.
Of the morning, Shane. How are you doing now?
I need more Irish people in my life to tell me how to talk in their terms. It's going great. Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
You need more stereotypical Irish people like that you'd see in like Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Oh, that's a classic.
That is.
I love that one. That one kind of messed me up a little bit with the
Banshees.
With the Banshees. Yeah, that one was a little bit freaky for me.
And he had that Irish lass with short hair.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just remember Sean Connery prancing around.
Yeah.
You know, not like his other movie, Zardust. Have you ever seen that?
Ardust?
Zardust or something like that?
No, I've never seen that.
It's a post-apocalyptic or like a different age futuristic movie where you have these mortals and the immortals, and the mortals are lustful and they wear like bikinis.
This is Sean Connery?
Yeah, and he wears this like kind of thick fabriced bikini, and he has a like an old school looking six shooter, and he's literally in a bikini.
At what phase of his career was this? Was this a pre-James Bond, during James
Bond?
No,
this was after.
After James Bond.
During, after, late period at least, but this was like early 80s, late 70s, somewhere in there.
So he had already reached his iconic status when he did this Zardost.
Right.
Land of the Bikini Models.
Right, and this is what I wanted to wear to a Halloween party if you would have had it. But now you're not, and so I'm going to have to run around my neighborhood in this Zardost bikini.
Oh, you'd be the hit of the neighborhood trick-or-treating with your kids and just wearing this leather. Was it a bikini, or was it like a leather? What do they call that? Your loincloth.
It wasn't even a loincloth. It was more like a man satchel.
Mm, interesting.
They wanted you to see Sean's bollocks. You know what I mean? But,
I saw this TikTok with old Sean, a snippet from his Barbara Walters interview.
Oh, that was a while ago, right? But yeah.
I thought, different times, dude. Different times. Yeah.
Was he what age was this in Sean Connery's career?
He was still towards the end. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say the end. It's probably the late 80s, maybe.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
It was early 90s. I didn't date it, but it had to at least been in the late 80s.
He still had the Rock.
He was kind of
to go to.
He was still kind of bald. I think it was pre-Rock.
No,
pre-Rock with Nicolas Cage. But Barbara really put him on the spot about slapping a girl up.
Oh, really? Like in life or in the movie?
Have you not seen this interview clip?
No, but he had hit a woman in real life?
Yeah, he said, I hate to speak of the dead, but let's just be historical about it. He said, yeah, sometimes, you know, when words fail and you've done your best and she still keeps on going, sometimes I think a little slap is necessary.
Holy crap.
And Barbara, like, put it to him a couple of times saying, wait, so you're saying that you're okay with this? And he said, yeah, perfectly fine. And the interview kept going. Like, it didn't, no mic drops, no crickets. It was just, yeah, sometimes you got to slap a girl up. She doesn't listen to you, doesn't back down. That's just normal. And I feel pretty good about that, he said. And I was like, whoa.
Wow, there's so much wrong with that.
Sean Connery would not have done well in today's climate.
No, you know, that's putting on your lenses history, right? You got to go back to that time and place and see where this person's coming from. Doesn't have to do with condoning it. But, you know, often our last podcast Jeff and I did was about a guy named Jefferson Standifer. And, well, this actually, what we're talking about is going to air in November. So, hello, November. But the thing is like you're looking at a guy who was a product of East Tennessee during the Civil War, right? Actually before 1830s, and then he moves to western Texas. At that point, it was Comanche land, and still part of the South in the Civil War, so like you have these allegiances, and he's a hero to some, villain to others. Some say he massacred all these, you know, as he would call them, snake Indians, right? But the Paiute, Shoshone, Bannock. But, it doesn't have to do with right or wrong. You're trying to analyze this person's, drives and belief systems. And Sean Connery's a product of patriarchy. That doesn't mean it's right. It's definitely wrong. But That's where it comes from.
So I think that we may have talked about this before once upon a time, but it's something that I struggle with in this, in our current cultural climate, is people are products of their generation, right?
And, right.
And how do you judge them? Do you judge them poorly? Like, do you go out and do you cancel Sean Connery because he laid hands on a woman and saying, oh, he knew better? How is it fair to judge people of the past on the standards of today? And if the answer is yes, I guess I'm a little confused by that, then I guess we're all probably guilty. But if answer is no, you shouldn't, then how do we look at them with a little bit more compassion? Like, I was listening to your and Jeff's podcast on Bill Wasmuth and his foibles up in Northern Idaho dealing with the oh my gosh, what's the main guy's name?
Richard Butler.
Richard Butler.
What a dick Butler is what Jeff and I call him.
I was listening to you guys talking about it, and I thought, man, he had his own experience. And I'm not condoning Richard Butler at all, but his life led him to a place that he thought these thoughts and he had these beliefs, and he didn't see, well, this is a set of beliefs laid in front of me, and oh, here's a different set of beliefs, but I'm going to choose these ones that are racist. I'm going to choose to be a racist. Does anybody ever have that choice and just say, I'm going to choose to be a racist?
I think some people are exceptional people can get out of an environment where they're surrounded by racists. Maybe they have one person that really helps them. Maybe they don't. Richard Butler was confusing to me because he seemed to have a lot going for him, right? Despite whatever economic woes were going on.
Served in the military. He seemed to have a decent amount of patriotism. But
he liked the Nazis.
Some fear in him caused him to gravitate towards this structure of beliefs that, I don't know, I guess that, I'm not saying that it's right, but I also think that we should be slow to judge people.
Right, right. Well, it's important to analyze somebody like Richard Butler, and it actually, you can see what creates somebody like that or somebody's like that, and then you can actually use, like, a lot of the people that helped other white supremacists, young white supremacists get out of that were people that had been white supremacists and knew the journey.
Yeah.
And could say, no, this is what they're telling you, and this is the reality, and this is why I found it to not be so.
Yeah, when you're on the inside, it's hard to see. You don't even know that you're on the inside or outside of anything. This is just your world, but you need somebody on the other side of that to say, hey, I was aware you are. Let me show you a different way to look at this.
Right.
And open your eyes up.
Lots of people have that, you know, and wow, this is an interesting conversation.
What are we even talking about?
We're
going to
talk about.
I thought we were talking about cool old Stibnite.
We are going to talk about Stibnite, the mining town, and also a type of ore. Mm-hmm. We went up there a year ago in the summer.
It pulled up on my iPhone with the photos. I think that it was a couple of. So we're just over a year, a little over a year. I want to say it was July of 22.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And you and I went and talked about on your Boise Bubble podcast, we talked about our time in Roosevelt, right? And this great old town that actually we were right in the right spot for where the cabins used to be from that place. And we were just looking at the remnants, you know.
Yep.
But we talked about that on your episode. But I wanted to talk more about Stibnite after I found out a little bit more about it. And for those that don't know, this is a mining community that's up in Central Africa. Central Africa.
It's a ways away. We were in the car for a while.
Right, yeah. It was a long trip. Central Idaho. That's more like it. We went up to this secluded area. And we saw history from all different periods of the mining boom. And I think I was most interested in what was newer, which is strange for me. It's usually the opposite. And so I wanted to learn more about it. And I knew I would use this kind of that time we spent up there, which was, it felt like a long time, but it was 24 hours?
Yeah, we were there over the course of, how many nights did we stay? Two nights up there? I think that we were two.
No, I think we were one, man.
Maybe only one. Short trip.
You had a burger thing to get back to.
Oh, man, your memory's impeccable.
Yeah,
you're right.
Having a burger thing here.
I don't even remember that, but I remember, there was a burger event. Sorry, that sounds boring. Anyway, history was awesome. Not everybody knows where Stibnite is or where that whole area is. When I came back and I was telling people about our trip, I had to explain that like 50 times where this place was. They were like, wait, where's it at? I said, it's right on the edge of the Frank Church.
Right.
And they're like, where's the Frank Church? Okay. You go up towards McCall. You go to Cascade. You cut over towards Warm Lake. Then you go north all the way up to Yellow Pine.
Yellow Pine.
And yeah, that's about where people kind of stop knowing where it's at.
Right. And then you, you go up the...
Yellow Pine was only like halfway.
Right. And because numerically, as far as mileage, it was like 13 miles to Stibnite. But you can't look at it that way because it's these small roads. You got to go slow. And you're going along with the east fork of the south fork of this Salmon River.
Yeah, yeah.
And correct. And then all of a sudden you come on this, like, this, what they call, I think it's hilarious, but the glory hole, you know. I'm like, they had those too? Oh, back when I was a young scamp in Seattle.
Terminology has changed through the ages.
Right, but I think that maybe they just played with that, you know, they had glory holes back then too, so they're joking about, like, what this thing is, but who knows? That's just my interpretation.
Okay.
But you know what I actually think the start of our conversation about time and perspective is, you know, this area is now a kind of hotbed of controversy when it comes to the need for mining and jobs, but also an economic boon for the economy, but also it can be a real problem and has been a real problem to the natural world around it, you mm-hmm. know, and all the, I call it terraforming, but they've totally transformed that area. And we're talking especially above the pit, the yep. Yellow Pine pit that you and I were above looking at all those old remnants. And so, you know, it's like, well, prove that pit and then, you know, the whole area, it is called Stibnite because from what I understand, that is where the ore is the Stibnite, and then you can get things, minerals like antimony and tungsten mm-hmm. out of it. And you can find like gold and other things in and amongst it. But it's something that was in 1939, we're getting ready for war. I think we know in America that it's going to get bad. So we're stockpiling important metals. And so Idaho is one of the 40, it became 40% of the domestic supply, the largest provider of, you know, tungsten and antimony in the nation. We got a lot of it from China, but, you know, shipping lanes were definitely shut down because of the Japanese mm-hmm. and then the Germans, of course, across the Atlantic. And so we had a hard time getting this out. So Stibnite became super important. It was really important. And just before we get into, you know, what we saw, and you might know this, Shane, but the antimony and the tungsten are metal. They create a harder metal when blended with other, you know, like steel.
Oh, yeah, of course. Everybody right? knows that. Antimony and tungsten.
Oh, yeah. It's like,
duh.
Geez, are you using titanium? What? You got to use... Well, I didn't know that tungsten was also, or is it the antimony? I think it's the antimony. It was also a fire retardant, I guess. And so you get that on couches and things, but they used them on tents and bags for troops on their clothing as a fire repellent.
Like they would powderize it somehow and then turn it into a coating?
Yeah.
Interesting.
It shrank your testicles, but at that point, nobody, you know, it's like, well, burn to death or have... Many testicles.
I know what I would choose. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you'd choose your balls.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No. I would, you know, that's a
send me
judgment.
To the flames.
Yeah, it's like, did I already have kids? Have I already had my, you know.
Yeah, I've got to apologize to you and all your geologist listeners. I can't carry the geology on this one.
Oh, I can't
Mark,
either.
Mark, you're going to have to carry this for us.
Dang.
Even the history, that's not my strong suit, but I am very interested in it. Like, that area was really cool.
Well, so, first off, we go to Yellow Pine, and a lot of the buildings in there were the frame buildings were removed from Stibnite. And Stibnite was actually, like, five different developments, right? Mm-hmm. And first one starting in, like, 39. But there had been mining up there since 1900, right? There had been mining before even, but major mining started in the Thunder Mountain area around 1900, you know, Roosevelt, where we went down mm-hmm. on, was that Lake Roosevelt?
It was yeah. Roosevelt Lake.
Roosevelt, and we went to the far end of it, and it was really great. But that's kind of where you see your old shacks. And in the area, mining went up into the 90s and 2000s. Now it's kind of reemerged from what I understand. But those shacks that were there during World War II, a lot of them were moved out in the 50s and put in yellow pine. Mm. So they survived somewhere. But I remember clearly we have this naturally beautiful canyon we're driving up next to the East Fork. And then we come around like a corner, and then all of a sudden we see this huge pit. Mm-hmm. And then we see down below we go, and we look into the pit from up above at the viewpoint, and you see these old buildings that were, I guess, balloon frame buildings is what they're called.
You're saying that those were originally up in Stibnite, and they took them down to the Yellow Pit Pine?
No. Yellow Pine, the actual village down mm-hmm. there, the town.
Right.
That's where the Stibnite houses are. But then we drove past those and then eventually up to the Yellow Pine Pit. And then down below where we hiked down to, if you mm-hmm. remember. And we found all that old construction. And I'm like, I think this is the 19-teens or 20s. Well, it's actually the 1930s. And so they built those in the 1930s, and that's where they would initially process the ore that they were bringing up out of that pit.
Right.
And then it would go through this whole process of, you know, crushing it and then, you know, eventually floating the minerals using, I think, arsenic or cyanide, something real potent and bad, but getting the minerals to float to the top. And then they'd extract those and send them to Cascade, and Cascade down like Salt Lake City, Boise. They'd fly it out sometimes from their airfield that they developed. They'd keep the roads open during the winter after 41 because it was so important in the war effort. Mm. And so that's kind of what we were walking around. So, I mean, it's cool that it was in the 30s now that I know how important it became. But, yeah, I mean, you had the first mines up there staked in 1914. I forget the man's name, but, you know, he sells the mine to, was it the United Mercury Company, and then they sell it to the Brady Corporation, the Brady Mining Corporation, and that's the company that kind of like takes it over in the 30s, and then bam, in the 40s, it's like they knew they
gangbusters.
Had
gangbusters, yeah,
because they knew they had tungsten up there and antimony from the beginning. It just wasn't as profitable as gold and silver and all that, and copper and whatnot. So they didn't mine. They didn't do much with it, and then World War II hits, and it becomes huge, and that's where you get the town we kind of went through,
mm-hmm.
The outskirt, the remnants of it, where you get, you know, up to 1,500 people live there from 41 to 45.
So I wonder what it looked like at the onset of the war versus when it ramped up, because I'm sure that once, at some point, they realized the value of the mineral that they're pulling out of this mountainside, right? And they probably invested a lot in roads to get up there to get it in, to get all that out. I'd be curious what it looked like in the beginning versus the end.
Right. In the beginning, what I do know, I read some personal accounts of, you know, just living up there as a kid. I read a history. It was kind of dry, but they kind of explained what it was. When this one guy gets up there in the 20s, you know, when it's part of the, was it Brady yet? But it was one of these companies owned this, and he said that you basically went and lived in a 15 feet by 60 foot log cabin barracks, and then there was a little kitchen attached to it, and that's what you lived in, you know, and you paid a little bit for your food each month, and there was a lot of snow, and
heck yeah,
and then, you know, during the summer months, there was a lot of mud. How they loved to recreate when they had time off, but they were doing 70 plus hours a week, you know, and some of the mines went horizontally into the mountain. Some of them went vertically down several hundred feet. You know, some of them were just pits. Like there was, as we saw, the biggest one became pit mining. And that was during the World War II years. And so it's just like a lot of work, a lot of hazardous chemicals, a lot of money pulled out of there, and, you know, it sounded like it was a really productive area, but, you know, the its true importance as a site, as the, you know, National Register of Historic Places say, they have these great essays, is 1939 to 1945, you know, it is really important to the war effort.
Right.
And so when you and I think my favorite time up there, well, it was a lot of fun, but we went to the Yellow Pine, processing buildings up above Yellow Pine and looking into that pit and hiked down there, and it was fun. But I think when we continued on deeper into the range, and we went to Stibnite, and you were way into the old foundations, and we have pictures of them all used for like an ad or something for this. But you're sitting there, and I'm sitting on the foundations, and we're kind of walking around this wooded area, and there's all these foundations. Well, those would have been for your more well-to-do families, you know, because it was all about seniority. Other people had just board and batten things without solid foundations.
Right.
Some had log cabins with tents, you know, and it all depended on who you were. And then, you know, they developed this town that we weren't able to find, right, because it's gone.
I was going to say, it felt like there were not, based on the number of people that were there, there were not nearly enough houses for that number of people. I could see how there definitely would be some kind of seniority or positional structure where, right, hey, if you're a such and such or a such and such, you get one of these real houses as opposed to a barracks.
And that shows you how far out it was. It's like to have a foundation on your home, perhaps mice or rats don't get in, you know, it keeps the snow from underneath your building. Rot doesn't get in as much. And some of these frame houses would fall down. It was actually the log cabins are the ones that remain, as we saw. Yeah, we saw one log cabins that date back to the early 1900s, and they're still there.
That, I think, is what stuck out to me even more than Stibnite. And I love Stibnite. There's something about that place that kind of resonated with me, but that we saw these older structures on the way out of there. I think it was when we left Stibnite and we went out towards Dunbar and Thunder Mountain,
right,
that we saw most of them, these really old cabins.
Yeah.
But anyway, kind of want to detract from Stibnite.
No, that's okay, because, you know, that was one of my favorite parts. I think I enjoyed the whole trip because we saw a bear and a couple bears.
That's pretty cool.
And then we go up and, you know, we camp at this pretty cool location, and then in the morning you're like, you got to go check this out, you know. And it was like, holy crap, that's the best cabin we've seen this whole time. And it was just,
we set up camp, it was dark,
yeah,
or it was twilight, couldn't see much, got our tent set up. Did we share a tent? I don't think that we share tents. I think that you were kind of weirded out by that.
I was. You were like, please just share a tent with me. I'm
Mark,
like,
I got tons of room. Come on, and it's so soft and cozy, and you wouldn't bite.
That was after that time that I asked you.
I was
you,
just testing you.
I was like, Shane, what type of underwear do you use when you're in the woods? And you were like, well, that's a strange question, Mark. And I said, well, it's because mine bunch up when I'm hiking. And you were like, well, that's why I wear a thong. When I'm glassing up there.
TMI, yeah, TMI.
You hike up the mountain, it's just like it doesn't get all bunched up and swassy.
Anywho, woke up the next morning, walked just a stone's throw to take my morning, what do they say, your morning relief.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm looking at this cabin that had to be 150 years old. This thing was so old. It was awesome.
It was very cool.
And it was so close, too.
Right.
Yeah, that whole area just feels like it's speckled with these gems, these historic gems.
And we were driving even in that area, and we went down some road just because we saw what might be like the start of some sort of facility, and it looked like it was from the 90s, you know?
The Dunbar mine, I remember that one still had remnants of equipment. They had the steel structure buildings.
Was that the Dunbar Dewey?
Yeah.
Dunbar was the...
Am I saying it wrong? Was it the Dewey mine? I think that it was the Dewey mine. Yeah. The Dewey mine, that they couldn't have vacated that, but in the 90s?
Right.
I mean, and it was pretty recent.
So one thing up there said, I don't know, it was specific to Stibnite or the mining district and all, but it was like in 96, they pulled a lot out. Mm-hmm. But now they're talking about going back in, right?
Right.
And so then there was the facilities get all kind of like, you know, unless you're from there and know a lot about it, they get all kind of mixed up. But I know that there was active mining in the area up there until 96, and I there still is some, as we saw.
So back to Stibnite, were you able to find anything about ownership? Like, how does I wonder how the economy of a mine works. Like, somebody or a group of somebodies has to invest in this site or purchase rights to this site, which is on public land. So I imagine that that's kind of an ordeal to get rights to mine on public lands. And then how does that work? I mean, to the point where you bring, what did we say, 1,500 people, 1,500 people up there at one time?
Right. Well, the,
in its heyday?
Yeah, the government, they don't take it, control of it, but if it was the Brady Mining Corporation or if it had been sold, but the U.S. Geological Service said, no, this is a high priority area. And so, you know, the from what I remember reading, the company, if it was Brady or something else at that point, they made mining this metal, the antimony and the tungsten, they made that the prime focus. And, you know, they're also selling, you know, gangbusters because it's so needed, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, okay, you're not going to produce these other metals at the time. You're going to get this and this, and it's part of the war effort. So it's what you need to do. You get great PR, and then you get, you know, great, you get a lot of money because you're just, the selling never stops. They just stockpiling this metal. And so it's a win-win for these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you can sell it at a higher rate, I guess, you know, because the government really needs it. And so that's your patriotic duty. And so a lot of the people that were working up there were like, you know, they're not fighting in the war, but they're fighting in the war. They're doing something productive, really productive for the war. So those miners were essential. They didn't have to fight because they wanted them to do that. You're essential worker, mm-hmm, in an essential industry. I do know that they owned, like, I believe you own like a specific area and then what's below it to a certain level. You know, it's very technical, and it can change. It's very confusing. I would respect anybody who would research this history that deeply.
Yeah.
You know,
mining economics and how that works with rights and limits.
Oh,
and,
hell. Like water control. It's just as confusing as that. It's like, well, what company owns it? What person owns it? Is it subsidized by the government? Is it a government project? Is it both? It's like, holy crap. That's what this is kind of like.
Yeah. But regardless, at one point, there's a lot of people up there. Couldn't believe how big this community was.
Right.
Remember, yeah, we were reading that they had a dance hall, they, mm-hmm, had an event center, they had all these facilities to support that many people. It was like a community. Like, they had to create community in order to keep this operation going.
Yeah, they had a bowling alley.
Yeah.
You know, they had a theater. And they would get new movies, you know, they would make sure, because it was important, the government would help them because it was important to have these people happy,
yeah,
you know, and pay them well and have them be as comfortable as possible. But I noticed, like, when I went fishing, I tried to be a fisherman once, and I told you this, but I was in Dutch Harbor, Alaska. Reading about life in Dutch Harbor is similar to reading about life in Stibnite. You have these really secluded areas, and they have a particular industry, and there's a lot of cohesion as a community around that, you know, and shared hardship,
mm-hmm,
you know, shared class level. You know, they had their own little government that ran that town up there, a board of,
yeah,
you know, governors. And you know, it just is like, you get these kind of places, and that's what Stibnite was for a while, you know. And just, it's interesting that, like, I want to read more into it and see, like, you know, the private stories that people had, but just the personalities of some of these people, you know, they're just very interesting. You had bad alcoholics and gamblers. They'd go Taiwan on, but when it came to work, they were ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had guys that would, like, fly out to Boise to gamble and party, and they, like, piss away all their money and then come back. You know, it's like, you had family men, you know, and they'd be probably like, I just mined for 70 hours straight. Like, you know, oh, you know. But one person was talking about how her dad would lay out the lesson plans for her before there was a major school, and be like, this is what I want you to do today, and then we can go over it when I get home. And, you know, like, that's, you had a lot of, like, love and devotion shown by mothers and fathers by how hard they worked, mm-hmm, to keep their kids in a comfortable enough position, you know.
And just the fact that they had families there was really interesting to me. when you read about some of these old, like gold mining, gold rush places, they seem like unsavory spots.
Oh, yeah.
Like not very conducive to the family way.
Oh, Roosevelt was definitely a scuzzy place.
Yeah, but the fact that Stibnite was different, what sticks out to me the most is, you know, you and I in modern age, most everybody moves from established community to established community, right? Like it's somebody already laid the foundation and we're living on top of it.
Right.
Stibnite was one that you could see its creation. It started as the mine and it developed this community.
Right.
Remember that what we were reading, like there's still an annual, is it an annual or it's a semi-regular picnic the ancestors of the people that lived at Stibnite, like their grandkids and great grandkids, and some of them are still, I'm sure, some old timers that actually live there still go up there.
One of the sources I read was a general history, I guess, from an old timer that was he was one of the geologists up there, and he wrote a history in 1979 on behest of one of the a group of these people at the gathering. They got together and, you know, they were like, please write a history of this place. And so he gets into the metal and the importance during World War II. But he talks about the personalities that, you know, worked there, you know, the guys who would carry guns around and, you know, the crew bosses that were all, you know, just hardened dudes, you know, like just you didn't mess with them, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so they had a lot of those stories, but, yeah, it was an interesting place because of all that. You know, one of the things that everybody would say is, you know, you would the dog sleds would come in and they'd have all these, you know, goods and important things to your town for your town, and they would fly in, and I was like, that must have been a scary flight. But they had a little airfield, and how, you know, you didn't waste a lot. You did a lot of hard labor at the house because who else is going to do it, right? And so, like, you know, the wife's, you know, ran the home, right? And whatever it was, the isolation of coming here from, like, Boise or Caldwell and then, like, flying in there or driving in there, and all of a sudden it's like, well, this is my life for, like, 5 years. But how they'd have a lot of fun sledding, hiking, fishing, some great fishing, right? It's kind of like problematic now. That's what they want to bring back. You know, the Nez Perce have spent millions and millions of dollars trying to establish, you know, fish somewhere down the river chain, where they now want to, at least, I don't know if they've done it yet, but build another pit, this company.
Interesting. I feel like we kind of brushed over it a little bit, but when we got to the Yellow Pine Pit, remember there was construction going on because they were building this bypass tube.
Right.
A tube that connected the river downstream from the pit to the water upstream of the pit, specifically for fish migration. You remember seeing that?
I do.
Informational sign?
Yeah, I do. And that's what, so the company, I, of course, I looked this up. And so if you guys are interested, just type in Stibnite Yellow Pine Pit, and you'll get Google hits with articles talking about this company. Oh, Midas Gold or Midas Mining. They want to divert the river, that, you know, was used to run into that area where the Yellow Pine Pit is that we were above. And then they diverted it. But the problem is it was too steep for the salmon to get up, you know? And so this is something that instead of the old days there, Midas is saying, well, we have the money to change this. Whereas there's no other way that this is going to happen. So we want to take some of the money that we're going to continue to make to reestablish these fish populations. But we also know that this is valuable, you know, for the economy and us and our shareholders, and we can do a lot of good for the area mining, but we also agree that we need to do it in a safe way so that you still get tourism, fishing for the Nez Perce and whoever else wants to go down there, fishing rights, right? And it can still be a ecological kind of tourist mecca as well, you know. And I think for me it's like, oh man, this is great trees and, you know, the environment and bears and rivers and all this, but also like, man, I love these ruins. But actually those are kind of like they're
kind
polluting
of at odds. Yeah.
Right.
I just love that they're taking steps to try to reintroduce fish up there. And it was significantly steep. I mean, I really walked out of the Yellow Pine pit with a ton of respect for fish. I mean, this underground tube system had to be at least a quarter mile, right?
Right. It was crazy. Like, and they were burying more of it. Like, they were
a quarter mile of significantly sloped pipe that these fish have to go through. And I want to say that the diameter of this tube was maybe 2 feet.
Right.
It couldn't have been too much bigger than 2 feet wide.
Well, and they're angling it so it, like, you know, they're grading the slope so that these fish can swim it. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're doing that too. And they're learning from, you're talking about, you know, learning from past mistakes. That's history for you. They're learning what not to do based upon what was done or not done. Mm. You know, and so I think I know there are some arguments on the environmental side, like, you know, you can do all you want and it's like, it's not going to be good for the environment. And they're saying, well, none of it will be good for the environment. So we're trying to do this.
Find balance.
And I think that's where we need to go in the future. Like, you got to have jobs. You got to help people have jobs. And when you have economic stability, you have a better situation overall, you know. Right. But you also can't just torch the environment wherever you go. We're learning that right now. I mean, obviously, we're paying the consequences.
But. Yeah, I hope that we can find some win-win solutions to some of these seemingly contradictory interests. Tell me a little bit about the wind down. Did you ever learn much about, like, because right now there's not much going on up there. There were some operations going, but it was not at all like the 1,500 people boom that had happened. What happened to finally kind of start winding that place down?
Well, you didn't have the amount, the need anymore for the tungsten and the antimony. But you also had some gold that's up there. You know, I think there still is, but the draw wasn't necessarily the gold, right, at that point or after. So you had a sharp decrease after the 1949. By the time, you know, 2 or 3 years later, stibnite was gone, you know. But you had mining still up and around there, obviously, but right. It hasn't ever been the continued, like, you know, during that breakneck period, there's never been that much consistency in what they pull out of there, you know. So I think they still want to, there's a continued need for, you know, now, for instance, batteries, right? Antimony is used in batteries. That was another thing that they made. So you have we run on batteries now, more, you know, like technologically advanced batteries. But I know that the metal is valuable for batteries, or for instance, the tungsten or antimony, I forget which one because I was reading a lot, but it's important in things like the screens on your phone mixed with plastics to make them harder, you know, and so there are new reasons to go get these metals. And so they want to be tapped into, or the companies that own that area want to tap into the stibnite ore and what's in it that is under the Yellow Pine glory hole, as we like to call it, you know. And so they want to mine that pit mine again. And so that's why they need to divert this river, the 4,000 feet or whatever it is, and then have the fish go through this ladder so that they can do it, right? So they want to get back in there, you know. And that's interesting. And so it's like, what, there still was some sort of presence, as we saw up there. But yeah, the future we'll see. But
kind of interesting, hard to believe that this place, when we went up there, it was a ghost town. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's a ghost town.
Right.
And to think that it might have a future beyond that, it's kind of interesting.
It is kind of interesting. And I think it might be one of these areas where it's like, what can you do to merge the environmental concerns with the economic concerns and make them somehow work together
right.
for the same goal? And I think, you know, it's like what you see down in Kentucky area, Arkansas, that area. Maybe we don't shave off the top of a mountain.
Yeah.
Maybe we can find another way to do this so that you have benefit to each. I don't know, because I don't see any side like changing, you know, their view that this needs to be done or that needs to be preserved as far as the environment. So it's like, you know, you got to find some common ground there. But You're asking some highfalutin questions, Shane.
I got some highfalutin curiosities,
Mark. Yeah, damn, Shane. Yeah, and I knew that. That's why I wanted to talk to you about that. But, yeah, so I wanted to know from you, what was your overall impression of just, like, how did it make you feel? What did you come back from that trip with as far as walking around these kind of, like, they're haunting in a way. Because you can almost feel the life that once existed around these ghost structures, you know, that are just sitting out there.
Yeah, man, I think about that place probably, I don't know, how do you put a number on it? But often, every other week or so. There, first of all, it took us a long time to get up there. And yeah. That mountain road was rough. And to think that the main passage in there back in the... I mean, what did we say that mining started around the 1900, right?
Right.
1899 or late 1800s. All right. Not everybody was flying a bunch of planes up there. So dog sled? How did they even get up there?
Yeah, the 20s.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the 20s. I mean, you had dog sleds for the winter. His name's not Halverson. But... one of the guys that first went out there to tap into and see what was out there went out there in the teens and then in the 20s continued to go out there on dog sled in the winter because he didn't want to wait. But also, you know, you had these eventually a rough road cut in there, but it was slow going.
I cannot imagine how long it would take to get from Boise up to Stibnite. I mean, that is so freaking far on a dog sled.
Which is why they brought in the plane eventually during World War II.
Right.
But, you know, like before that, I mean, it was hours and hours just to get to Cascade.
I feel like once you got up there, like I'm always putting myself in the headspace of a person who lived there, right? Man, I had to work my butt off to get here. Like, I can't imagine them ever thinking, well, I'm done up here. Let's go back to Boise, then go explore someplace else. Like, they must have thought, this is where my life is going to play out. There's a large probability that I'm probably going to die up here.
Right,
because it took so much work to get there.
I think in the early days, like, I mean, you're playing Russian roulette because there's so many ways to die in the elements. Uh-huh. You know, as you went on to Stibnite, I definitely think that people felt like, oh, this is going to be a sizable chunk and adventure in my life. I was likening it to when I went to the Peace Corps, you know, when Mikhail and I went to the Peace Corps, my wife. It was very much like, wow, this is going to be a huge adventure in my life, and it's going to be supremely, you know, impactful mm-hmm. on my life. And I think that's what a lot of the families talked about. Like, you know, this is, it's A, important to the war effort. And, you know, like talking about how you had to black out windows because they didn't know if the Japanese, especially early on, were going to like send bombing raids. We didn't know.
Into Idaho?
Into Idaho. I mean, they did attack Alaska, you know, the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah, Idaho's a little further inland.
But they didn't know. They were doing fire bombs, you know, and it was only a few times. But, like, you know, in 42, especially when the war wasn't going supremely well for the United States, you know, it took time to get this industrial might, including mining, going.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, early on, this woman is describing when she was a kid and they had to black out their windows, both in Boise and then later on, like, in Stibnite, they had to, you know, they had to be careful about flashy stuff because they did want it to get bombed.
Crazy.
You know, it was like it was a real important structure or location. So
you just didn't know how dangerous it was.
Right. You know, and
you feared the worst, and so they overreacted. I don't know why face masks are coming to my mind right now. Edit that part out.
People in the face masks. Yeah.
You don't know. Like, because of fear, you don't know how to what extent do you have to be safe.
Right.
Because I just don't know anything about this thing. Can the Japanese get to Idaho? Maybe. I don't know. Black out your windows just in case.
Right. Yeah. And you know, they did that. It would make more sense on Seattle, but they were still afraid that this could happen in Boise, you know, in Nampa, Caldwell. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I think one of my other takeaways was I left there feeling, I don't know, a deep sense of mortality. These communities tried, they started, these people had the individuals had these little individual cabins, right? I mean, we saw so many of these little tiny cabins or remnants of cabins. Someone lived out a big chunk of their life at this little cabin. So people's stories just, at some point, they disappeared around there. Stibnite disappeared. The Dewey Mine disappeared. All these places where people moved and lived their lives, now they're being overgrown. And I don't know why that sticks in my mind so much, just to think, I guess we're never totally secure, right? This thing could go belly up. And
right. I was expecting zombies to come out of the woods. It's like it looks post-apocalyptic.
I remember walking at a, this is going to be a weird pivot, but to Tamarack Resort up there in Cascade.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after they had shut down. So this is probably, I don't know, 6-7 years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago. But we took a walk around the golf course, and the golf course was like, nature had reclaimed most of the golf course.
Oh, sweet.
It was cool to see these greens, these fairways, these tee boxes where people were playing golf, to just see how quickly nature came back and just covered it back up again.
I wonder why they shut down the golf course. Just somebody just got rid of it?
Tamarack has its own history that might be interesting to dig into. Did you know that they're looking at redeveloping it, at opening things back up and building a bunch of stuff up there?
Isn't Tamarack still a thing, though?
It is.
Yeah, yeah, there's a ski. Is a ski.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. On the way to McCall?
Correct.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to go on the into Cascade, Donnelly, and then over the north side of, what is it, Lake Cascade,
right?
To get over to the west side of it, and that's where Tamarack is. Anyway, don't mean to digress, but just to think that it does not take a lot of time for nature to come back and just wipe all signs of life off the face of it, and all that you have is a couple of foundations. Or
people are fascinated by those things. You know, I'm sure you've seen them on Instagram or TikTok, where people just go to these old rundown houses or places that, you know, maybe some old couple died and nobody's been in that house for like 10 years, you know, and it's just, you know, it starts, it's whatever stage in decay it is. I think something like a golf course sounds fascinating, because it's not something I would expect to be, you know, overgrown and changing, you know, like that, being like claimed once again by the wilds, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I figured good for the wilds. You know, I like that it's a golf course, because George Carlin had this great bit where he's like, you want to end homelessness? He's like, reclaim the fucking golf courses. He's like, you get these rich assholes. You know, and I'm like, you know.
Dude, if there was ever a prophet, George Carlin a prophet.
Yeah.
My final takeaway was just the tenacity of people. I mean, the Frank Church Wilderness is hard country. That whole area up there is hard country, that people even made it up there to discover ore deposits.
Right.
And that people these days go up there to hunt. I have a buddy that hunts the Frank Church every year. He goes up there hunting elk. And you could not pick a harder area to hunt in Idaho than the Frank Church. It's just, it's so steep and treacherous and desolate. It's crazy. And I am just amazed that people made it up there and scratched a living up there for as long as they did.
Well, we made it pretty high up there, and we were on Thunder Mountain, mm-hmm. you know, and we're just like, well, we can't continue on right now. You know, it's just, we got to make our way. And, you know, you had to get back to grill some burgers. And
you keep downplaying my burger.
No, but you have the same addiction to me. You're like, oh, well, you know, we did not have the proper amount of time to go hike down to Roosevelt, you know, but you're like, oh, I'm sure we can do it. I'll get home in time.
It was worth it.
I'm thinking in my head, I'm like, yeah, you're never going to get home in time, but that's not my problem. Let's go down.
If he's willing to do it.
I have to see it. I have to see what's around the bend, you know? And we saw so many time periods, you know, in one geographical area, that I was just like, I didn't expect all that. And I really liked it. And, you know, I didn't know then how important Stibnite was. And so now it's like, oh, yeah. You know, that's the thing about teaching history by going to these sites. I think it's a shame almost that they're so excluded, or distant.
Secluded.
Secluded, thank you. Mark, no speak good.
I'm your word wingman.
Thank you. That's a good one. You should put that on a shirt.
Coined it.
Yeah, but, you know, these would be valuable things to preserve. But how do you do that, you know? And the Smithsonian has been looking at ways to, like, preserve barns, old barns, and farmhouses, and things that are made with wood, you know?
Yeah. wood has a half-life. I mean, eventually it's going to disappear.
Right.
And become dust. I would just encourage anybody to go out there. Just go explore this state. People think of Idaho and they think of the mountains and the skiing and they think of the cities as they are currently. But, I mean, there's some rich history all around here. And it deepened my appreciation going up there and seeing these old places and thinking of what life was like back in those days. And it just gave a little bit more context to what we're living in now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I have a greater understanding or I guess respect for, you know, miners. You know, I had respect for what they did, but there was always, you know, there was like all these environmental concerns. But I would say that after that, I have a more balanced view of the other side.
Right.
I see both sides more. And because I read into, you know, the importance of the mines. And I think Stibnite is a perfect example. It was like, yeah, we knew the environmental impacts were going to be bad at that time period, but we also were fighting against the Nazis and the Imperial Japan.
Yeah. And so, an existential threat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So
hard choices.
Right. And it's all reflected in that site. And it was fun to go up there.
Man, I'm glad that we did it. We need to pick another site and go and do a little bit of exploring one of these days.
I want to go to southeastern Utah to the home of truth where there was a cult where they mummified a woman.
Really?
Yeah. Get our book, Murder and Mayhem.
oh.
We have another one, Haunted Boise coming
Modern
out.
Mummies.
Yeah, Modern Mummies. In fact, I was just on the phone with a friend of ours, her name's Chelsea. What's your last name, Chelsea? Dang it. Pearl House Collective, and is her bookstore. Actually, she changed it to the Lit Room, like Literature Room.
Mm-hmm.
And she just is leasing something in Garden City, a really cool bookshop that she's now starting to fill in. And on October 11th from 7 to basically 9:30 p.m., we're going to have Alliteration Ales there.
Yeah.
The Boise Book Nerds Club. The Lit Room bookstore will be open and flourishing, and I'm going to be, I don't know if this sounds more poetry-esque, but giving a reading.
Ooh,
and I
that's
think
right.
I don't know. And we're going to be on Lectures by Lushes on October 20th at Mad Sweet Brewing, where apparently we get to drink some powerful ales beforehand.
They're going to fill you up and then put you on stage.
Yeah.
When is this happening?
October 20th, 2023.
Then you got to release this before that, right? You said that it might be November.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. Yeah, this is
there
coming
might
out
be
in November.
Some value in dropping this thing before that. Yeah, I was going to plug your book and all this stuff. This is awesome. You just had a great book released, and by the time that people hear this, I'm sure they will have read it twice.
Yeah, Jeff and I both flourish in telling weird, strange, odd tales, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what we've done, and I think this book is better than Murder and Mayhem, actually. I like it more.
Title being Haunted Boise? Or
Haunted Boise.
Haunted Boise. Great thing to read as we're going into the Halloween season.
Oh, right, yeah. And you'll actually learn something besides just hauntings, too, because every haunting has a great bit of history behind it. So,
yeah.
Well, thanks for being on my show.
Man, awesome talking to you.
On our show, again. Jeff and I, but he's not here today. Couldn't be. Alas, he's working. But great
Thank
to
you.
Talk to you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Later.